I want to start with a story, one which I think has great resonance for people who think there's too much money in American politics, but one which I think teaches us the wrong lesson. In the spring of 2014, a group of Republican presidential hopefuls, including Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey, converged on the Venetian Hotel in Las Vegas to speak before the Republican Jewish Coalition and its key board member, the billionaire casino mogul and Venetian hotel owner, Sheldon Adelson. It was a big moment for Christie, who was trying to get past a controversy known as Bridgegate over the closing of lanes on the George Washington Bridge, allegedly in retaliation for against Fort Lee's mayor, a Democrat who does not support Christie's re-election bid for governor. The speakers at the conference, the former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, Ohio Governor John Kasich, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, and Christie, fell all over themselves to flatter Adelson and to announce their support for a continued strong relationship between the United States and Israel, Adelson's signature issue. Walker, according to a New York Times story, brought up his father's trip to Israel, said he puts a menorah candle next to his Christmas tree, said that his son, the name of his son Matthew, actually comes from the Hebrew. But Christie stepped in it. In a speech to the group, he warmly recalled a trip took with his family to Israel, calling it an extraordinary personal experience. But he set off disapproving whispers from the crowd when he described flying over the, quote, occupied territories where the Palestinians live. To conservative supporters of Israel, who believe Israel has the right of sovereignty over these lands captured during the Six-Day War, it was a faux pas to call them occupied territories. Christie quickly apologized in a private meeting with Adelson. Progressives denounced the line to kiss Sheldon Adelson's boots, or perhaps a bit higher up. The candidate seeking Adelson's stamp of approval on his cash, and Christie's apology to Adelson for describing the disputed regions with a term regularly used by US presidents and the US government. But who could blame Christie for participating in the Sheldon primary and for his obsequiousness? Adelson and his wife had contributed an astounding $98 million to $150 million during the 2012 elections, thanks to holes in our disclosure laws, we're not sure exactly how much, to help elect Republican candidates during the 2012 election, including giving more than $15 million to a super PAC called Winning Our Future that seemed to single-handedly allow former House Speaker Newt Gingrich to remain in the 2012 race for the Republican presidential nomination. The Adelsons later gave tens of millions more to support Mitt Romney's bid for president against Barack Obama. And the 2016 presidential hopefuls wanted Adelson's support. But more importantly, they wanted his money. But if the lesson that progressives drew from the Chris Christie story is that big money is simply buying elections, that claim was off the mark. Instead, Adelson's money bought Gingrich's 2012 presidential campaign only a second and a third and a fourth look from Republican primary voters, but they ultimately rejected him. Romney beat Gingrich in the primary, but then even with support, significant support from Adelson, Romney lost to Obama in a campaign where each side spent about $1 billion. So we can begin our consideration of the problem of money in American politics by rejecting the crass liberal refrain that money simply buys elections. The eBay entrepreneur Meg Whitman's $140 million in self-financed cash did not allow her to beat Jerry Brown to become California's governor in 2010. It seems the more she spent on her election ads, the less Californians liked her. Similarly, environmentalist Tom Steyer's efforts to keep a Democratic majority in the US Senate in 2014 failed, despite his spending nearly $74 million on the effort. And in an electoral earthquake in 2014, Dave Bratt, an unknown college professor with two full-time staffers, beat Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, in a Virginia congressional primary. Cantor's campaign literally spent more on dinners at steakhouses than his opponent Bratt spent in his entire campaign. And as Jeb Bush shows us, the relationship between money and politics is more complicated than mere vote buying. Despite $110 million spent, Bush got nowhere. Money can't buy you, Jeb. We can also reject the claim that progressives sometimes make that money bribes politicians. Take the group United Republic, represent us. The group backs the American Anti-Corruption Act. The website supporting the legislation is headed Get Money Out of Politics, Stop Lobbyist Bribery, End Secret Money and Empower Voters. Its first point for why the legislation is necessary, stop politicians from taking bribes. But as Harvard professor and campaign reformer Larry Lessig explains, most members of Congress are not taking bribes. And cash for vote corruption is about as rare as it has ever been in Congress. Sure, there are the occasional stories. Republican Representative Randy Duke Cunningham of California went to jail for getting a yacht and other goodies from defense contractors while he sat on the House Defense Committee. And Democrat William Jefferson of Louisiana was caught in an FBI bribery sting when he was arrested with $10,000 of literally cold cash in his freezer. But neither man was bribed by legal campaign contributions. Federal candidates legally can take no more than $5,400 every 2 years from an individual. Who in Congress could be bought so cheap? Super PACs such as the one supporting Gingrich cannot give their large sums directly to candidates. But they can raise unlimited funds so long as they do not violate the weak federal rules against coordination with candidates. The few members of Congress who are taking bribes are not taking them primarily through legal campaign contributions, at least not yet. But reformers and reform groups like Common Cause talk the language of corruption all the time. Lessig, for example, talks about the problem of what he calls dependence corruption, in which the system is corrupted by politicians dependent upon campaign funders to remain in office, rather than being dependent upon the people alone. It's hard for reformers to avoid the corruption talk. To begin with, corruption resonates with the general public. A poll commissioned by the group Represent Us found support for campaign reform jumped from 60% to 72% when the measure was packaged as an anti-corruption measure. Using the term broadly, corruption can mean lots of things, including just a deviation from a perfect state of nature. But there's another stronger reason why everyone in the election reform business talks about corruption all the time. And that reason has distorted Americans' thinking for the last 40 years, and it's the Supreme Court of the United States. In 1976, the Supreme Court decided a case called Buckley versus Valeo, which upheld some parts of a 1974 federal campaign finance law and struck down others, finding some parts of the law violated the United States Constitution's First Amendment, which, among other things, guarantees freedom of speech and association. Buckley said that a limit on money in politics could be justified only by the government's interest in preventing corruption or the appearance of corruption. And just as importantly, the court rejected the idea that the government could limit money in politics to promote political equality, an idea which the court in Buckley called, quote, wholly foreign to the First Amendment. This singular focus on corruption explains the Supreme Court's constantly shifting approach to the constitutionality of campaign laws. Liberal justices read the term corruption broadly and vote to uphold many campaign finance limits. Conservatives read the term narrowly and vote to strike down just about everything. Witness the current era of skepticism that we are in now. This is why a host of reformers and academics try to shoehorn all kinds of ideas under the label corruption. Justice Anthony Kennedy, writing for the Supreme Court in 2010 in the case Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, explained that when large donors and spenders ingratiate themselves with elected officials to secure access to them, this is not corruption. Ingratiation and access, Justice Kennedy assured us, or the appearance of ingratiation and access, provide no reason for limiting money in politics. Such money will not cause the public to lose confidence in the fairness of the electoral process, he told us. Citizens United, a 5-4 decision pitting the court's conservatives against the court's liberals, opened up a new era of spending in federal elections and fueled the emergence of super PACs and other outside groups. In a 2014 case, McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission, Chief Justice John Roberts went even further, celebrating the idea of politicians responding to the wishes of big donors and spenders. Not only are ingratiation access not corruption, Roberts told us. Donors, Roberts explained, quote, embody a central feature of democracy, that constituents support candidates who share their beliefs and interests, and candidates who are elected can be expected to be responsive to their concerns. So let's unpack this for a second. Roberts is saying that in a democracy, we should want politicians to be most responsive to the highest bidders. The New Citizens United era is not full of corrupt politicians taking bribes, or of elections going to whoever spends the most money. To claim that's the problem puts the public's spotlight in the wrong place, looking for elected officials to take large amounts of money for private gain. That's not the problem. The more central problem of money in politics is something just as troubling, but much harder to see. It's a system in which economic inequalities, inevitable in our free market economy, are transformed into political inequalities that affect both election outcomes and political outcomes. Without a single politician taking a single bribe, wealth has an increasingly disproportionate influence on our politics. While we can talk about that as a problem of corruption, this pushes the limits of the word too far, certainly too far for the Supreme Court, which has started to read corruption to mean quid pro quo bribery. And it obscures the fundamental unfairness of a political system moving towards plutocracy. The political power of the wealthy is especially troubling in our current period of rising economic inequality when those with the greatest economic clout are using their increased political power to protect their privileged economic position. Most of the important money in politics action happens not in the glare of the television cameras at the Venetian in Las Vegas, but in steakhouses and golf courses all around Washington, D.C., where lobbyists, often former senators, members of Congress, or staffers, do their ingratiation and secure their access. There's a reason big business pays lobbyists so well. And it is not because lobbyists are information specialists who help create sound public policy. For every $1 in lobbying spent by consumers, $34 is spent by business interests. Lobbies secure access both by bundling campaign contributions and using personal connections. It should be no surprise that half of retiring senators have become lobbyists, many with seven-figure salaries, and that lobbyists who used to work for a senator see their income fall immediately by a quarter when that senator that they used to work for retires. Money works especially well in the shadows. Lobbyists, like mushrooms, thrive in low light. The New York Times reported how lobbyists for Wall Street and gaming interests convinced Senator Harry Reid of Nevada to add 54 words to a must-pass 2,000-page omnibus spending bill. Those 54 words saved the lobbyist clients over $1 billion in taxes. The company of one of Reid's top donors admitted to being among those involved in the discussion with congressional staff members of the insertion of those 54 words into this 2,000-page bill. Money couldn't stop the passage of the Dodd-Frank bill, which regulated the securities industry against the industry's wishes. Public outrage over the 2008 financial crisis was just too great to overcome. But once public attention faded, moneyed interests could work their magic, using influence to water down implementing legislation and regulations aimed at stalling or stopping much of what Dodd-Frank promised to achieve. In this new era of super PACs and non-disclosing social welfare groups spending millions of dollars on elections, it's no longer just the access that matters. Money's potentiality alone is enough to get someone to shift their priorities, a point that former senators, but less often current ones, publicly acknowledge. The result is that money systematically skews public policy, even if it does not buy elections. As Professor Martin Gillens of Princeton and Benjamin Page of George Washington have shown, public policy across a wide range of issues regularly skews towards the interests of the wealthy and the well-organized, and against the poor and the disorganized. With the new wave of campaign finance deregulation giving the wealthy more chances to leverage their influence, there's every reason to believe this trend will accelerate. Well, just how concentrated is the wealth funding our elections? A recent New York Times study by Mikan Vasori noted that there are about 120 million households in the United States. 120 million. But then a mere 158 families contributed nearly half the money funding the 2016 presidential elections. 158 out of 120 million. The largest super PAC supporting Hillary Clinton saw a situation where 33 donors gave 90% of the money to support that super PAC. So who are these people funding our elections? These 1% of 1%ers are not like the rest of us. A study by Paige Bartels and Seawright found that these people are not only better connected than the rest of us, with most of them reporting having personally contacted a senator or representative. Their views are also much different than that of most Americans. The wealthy are much less likely to support higher taxes on the rich, what a surprise, a decent Social Security safety net, and a minimum wage which is high enough to keep people out of poverty. In the electoral realm, money matters, even when it does not dictate the outcome of elections. As we saw, Newt Gingrich got a second and a third and a fourth chance to be the Republican presidential nominee, not because that's what many Republican voters wanted, but because that's what Sheldon Adelson wanted. Meg Whitman got her chance to run against Jerry Brown and convince Californians that she'd be a better governor, not because she had better ideas than thousands of other Californians who were convinced they'd be a great governor of California, but because she had $140 million to burn on the chance. Someone said she could have bought a small island for that amount. Furthermore, advertising alone does not necessarily sway voters who are engaged in and have strong political opinions. In a close election, it could sway enough swing voters, generally the least informed and most easily persuadable voters, to affect an outcome. Lessig is exactly right that politicians depend on the funders and not only the people for their jobs. There's a reason political scientists refer to the money primary, which occurs before the actual primary, as politicians seek to raise money in living rooms in certain zip codes. This raises a concern, though, not about corruption, but about the wealthy donors' disproportionate influence over elections and policy. So why not simply limit money in politics to promote a level playing field? Leveling the ability to contribute and spend money on politics would not create perfect equality. We probably wouldn't want to achieve perfect equality even if we could get it. But it would be a reasonable step in that direction. Yet depending upon how society writes and implements such laws, they could have profoundly bad effects, censoring political activity, entrenching incumbents over challengers, and giving special treatment to media corporations. These are not trivial concerns, and any argument to talk that is going to be serious about limiting money in politics cannot simply sweep them aside. Courts grapple with these issues when opponents of regulation challenge these laws as violating the First Amendment, which, as we've seen, provides that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. The words of the First Amendment are not self-defining, and ever since Buckley, the Supreme Court has vacillated over how to strike this balance between individual rights and society's interests. In the past, it has sometimes upheld limits on corporate money in elections, essentially on political equality grounds, although dressed up as an anti-corruption argument. These days, however, the conservative majority of the Supreme Court, over the strenuous objection of the more liberal justices, has embraced the First Amendment attack on campaign finance. The First Amendment critique is serious, yet many Democrats ignore it. In 2014, 43 Democratic senators co-sponsored a proposed constitutional amendment to, quote, overturn Citizens United. The amendment's text raised concerns about free speech and political competition that Democrats dismissed without making a serious response. Mostly Democrats pay lip service to reform. The former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has repeatedly attacked the Koch brothers and their network of supporters for funneling hundreds of millions of dollars into federal, state, and local elections, much of it without disclosure. Reid has claimed that Republicans are, quote, addicted to Koch. And there is merit to his claim that Republicans increasingly depend on large donors for their campaigns. If you thought that the Adelson $100 million was a lot of money, the Koch brothers last year and their network of 400 people had pledged to spend about $900 million on the 2016 elections. They've since backed away from this pledge because they don't like Donald Trump. But they have been pouring tens of millions of dollars into advertising and voter registration efforts in an effort to keep the Senate Republican. Many of the ads you see on television in the Senate race supporting Pat Toomey are being backed by Koch Brothers money. This is an effort which, whether the Koch brothers like it or not, will help Donald Trump get people registered, get Republicans to the polls. So there's much to be concerned about. But Reed is a Koch addict too. He uses the brothers as a political foil to raise funds for Democrats. In any case, Democrats also are increasingly dependent on large money, and money skews their priorities as well. Witness the Democrats' great support protecting the interests of Wall Street. Although Democrats in office tend to rail against Citizens United in the Supreme Court, some Democratic lawyers are secretly ecstatic about the brave new world of campaign finance that the Supreme Court has unleashed. In the close 2014 race for control of the US Senate, Democratic-leaning super PACs outraised their Republican counterparts. Democrats in 2014, not Republicans, were the ones who engineered a secret congressional deal to vastly increase the contributions political parties could accept. I don't know if you saw the story in yesterday's New York Times on Hillary Clinton's fundraising. You want to get into the fundraiser? You must write, not raise, at least $100,000. President Obama has been a master of hypocrisy, castigating the Supreme Court for opening up the floodgates of money, but undermining the public financing system for presidential campaigns. He was the first candidate to decline public money in the general election, a perhaps reasonable choice at the time, given the inevitability of the program's collapse. But he reneged on his promise to fix this for the future. Indeed, he became the first president to transform his presidential campaign committee into a 501c4 social welfare group that can now take unlimited and secret donations to support his agenda. The group, now called Organizing for America, is voluntarily disclosing the names of donors giving at least $250. Don't expect the next president to be so generous. While Democrats try to have it both ways on campaign finance, Republicans have united behind a deregulatory agenda. The John McCains of the party, who used to be leaders supporting bipartisan reform efforts, have gone silent. While the Mitch McConnells, who have long fought limits and called for full and easy disclosure, now fight the very disclosure laws they used to support. As with most debates in Washington, the debate lacks nuance. And even on the merits, it's been hampered by the Supreme Court's insistence that any justification for limits be framed in anti-corruption terms, and the willingness of activists and scholars to go along with this unhelpful framing. We must consider the potential for campaign finance laws to promote and preserve political equality. First Amendment critics are right that limiting money in elections raises the risk of censorship, incumbency protection, and unfair preferential treatment of the media. The difficult but essential task is to develop a plan that both protects robust political speech in elections and guards against the rise of a plutocratic class that has too much influence over both election outcomes and what elected officials do once they're in office. Promoting political equality is a compelling interest that can justify some measures to limit money in politics, but that do not squelch too much political competition. So how do we do it? Let's start by putting campaign finance vouchers in the hands of all voters to democratize our elections. A vouchers plus limits program would give each voter $100 in each two-year election cycle to donate to candidates, to parties, and to interest groups. Think Sierra Club or the NRA or Planned Parenthood, who are playing in federal elections. Vouchers would give everyone a stake and a say in funding our elections, helping to ensure that campaign funding reflects actual public support. Vouchers would be coupled with limits. No individual could contribute in the aggregate more than $25,000 for any single federal election, or $500,000 on all federal elections in a two-year cycle. Other rules would limit the campaign finance activities of lobbyists. Now, for most people, these limits present no impediments at all. If I'm told that I can't spend more than $500,000, it's not going to stop me from doing anything I want to do. But such limits do stop the Allisons, the Kochs, and the Steyers, and the McCutcheons of the world from spending all they want on political speech. And so the question is, why isn't this unconstitutional censorship in violation of the First Amendment under Buckley and Citizens United? And for that, I want to turn to one more story. Benjamin Blumen hardly seemed like a threat to American democracy. But a lawsuit he filed with another plaintiff in 2011, Blumen versus Federal Election Commission, could have allowed the Chinese government, a large Russian corporation, or Mexican billionaires to spend millions of dollars to get someone sympathetic elected to Congress, a governorship, or the presidency. Blumen is a Canadian citizen who went to law school in the United States on a student visa and then worked as an associate in a New York City law firm on a temporary work visa. In 2011, he wanted to contribute to three Democratic candidates, including President Obama, print flyers supporting Obama's re-election bid, and distribute the flyers in Central Park. These days, he's a lawyer in Vancouver. Under federal laws limiting the campaign finance activities of foreign individuals, corporations, and governments, Blumen could not contribute or spend in U.S. elections. Congress has tightened up those laws after finding evidence that foreign citizens in the Chinese government had made donations in the 1996 campaign. Under current law, the only foreign individuals who have permanent residency status are the ones who are allowed to have the same right as American citizens to contribute or spend in American elections. The Blumen lawsuit asking for permission to engage in this spending was the brainchild of Yakov Roth, a Canadian lawyer and Harvard Law School classmate of Blumen, who had clerked for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and who went to work at Jones Day, one of the top law firms in Washington, D.C., the law firm, by the way, that's now representing Donald Trump. The suit followed both the playbook and the legal reasoning of the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United case, but without the same results. The playbook: find a sympathetic, small potatoes plaintiff to mount a First Amendment challenge to a major federal campaign finance law. A challenge that, if successful, would open the door for much bigger actors. Blumen told the press, quote, "It seems nonsensical to me that I am allowed to go to Central Park and tell every person I see why I think they should vote for Obama. But if I go to Kinko's and I spend 50 cents to print out on a piece of paper the words vote Obama and then show it to one person, I've committed a federal crime punishable by up to $10,000 in fines or 5 years in prison." Of course, campaign reformers were not really concerned about this Canadian lawsuit and his flyers in Central Park and his 50 cents of spending at Kinko's. They were worried that if he won his case, it would allow outside forces to spend millions of dollars to tilt the results of US elections. With so much at stake, one didn't have to be a xenophobe to distrust foreign influence over US elections. The suit argued that under Citizens United, spending money on ads independent of a candidate cannot corrupt the candidate. And therefore, under the First Amendment, the government cannot limit such spending. What's good for the corporation, Blumen argued, is good for me. But Blumen failed. A three-judge panel of the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C., an opinion by Court of Appeals judge and likely Republican Supreme Court shortlister Brett Kavanaugh, rejected the plaintiff's arguments and upheld the ban on foreign spending. The case went up to the Supreme Court under an obscure statutory provision that all but guaranteed the court would give the case a full hearing. But the justices did not bite. Without argument or discussion, the court simply affirmed the lower court's ruling. I've reprinted for you the entire text of the Supreme Court's ruling. Leading First Amendment zealots, surprisingly, do not disagree with Blumen's total ban on foreign money. Floyd Abrams, the country's leading First Amendment lawyer, has been an admirable defender of unpopular speakers and causes. Yet when I debated him at the University of Michigan in March 2012, I asked him his view on Benjamin Blumen and the ban on foreign money in elections. Why limit Blumen's spending on campaigns if the Supreme Court was right in Citizens United that the identity of the speaker doesn't matter? More speech is always better. Abrams' response was unconvincing. I do think that foreign influence is different than American influence. Maybe it's question begging to say it, but I do think that different considerations come into play when you're talking about whether we as a nation choose to allow foreign nations to play in our elections. Bradley Smith is also a strident free speech supporter, whose book, Unfree Speech, is perhaps the most influential book-length argument against campaign finance regulation. A professor at Capital University Law School in Ohio and formerly chaired the Federal Election Commission, he's the brains behind the Center for Competitive Politics, a public interest group in Washington that brought us super PACs. Yet despite his agitation for campaign finance deregulation, Smith was not at all bothered by the total and absolute ban on Benjamin Blumen passing out his cheap flyers in Central Park. After the Supreme Court upheld the ban without even issuing an opinion, Smith wrote on his center's website that, quote, well-known Lockean principles about the nature of political communities suggest that different rules might apply to persons who are not members of the political community, persons who are mere temporary residents. Smith supports the government's ability to strip a human being, Benjamin Blumen, of his right to spend a penny to support a federal candidate based on a judgment made by self-interested legislators that Blumen is not sufficiently part of our political community, so as to have the right to speak about American elections. But Smith derides as censorship and incumbency protection a federal law that limits, but does not fully deny, the ability of non-human corporations to spend money in federal elections. Corporations, legal fictions that exist only by grace of the state, are entitled to infinitely more political speech, as Smith measures it, than an actual human being living in New York. Self-interested legislatures can decide that different rules might apply to foreign individuals. But in Smith's view, they cannot make that same judgment about artificial entities such as corporations, endowed by their creator with nothing like a human spirit. The Indiana attorney Jim Bach has probably filed more suits against campaign finance laws than anyone else in the United States. He was the brains behind Citizens United and many other challenges to campaign finance limits. A strong opponent of abortion and same-sex marriage, Bach is one of those no-law-means-no-law First Amendment absolutists when it comes to campaign finance, with one big exception. When the Supreme Court summarily affirmed the Blumen case, Bach defended it. It's perfectly consistent for the Supreme Court to hold that there's no compelling interest in prohibiting corporate labor union speech, but there is a compelling interest prohibiting foreign interests from contributing to candidates in U.S. elections. I, for one, agree that the Red Chinese Army, the Iranian government, and Hamas can be prohibited from contributing. What's most ironic about Bob's comments is that they support the foreign money ban, even though the ban is not, to use a First Amendment phrase, viewpoint neutral. Bob wants to shut up Hamas, the Chinese army, the Iranian government, presumably because of what they might say and where they might spend their money. So let's stop with all the talk about censorship and start talking about sensible limits on money in campaigns. We all agree that some limits make sense. The question is, which ones? Preferential treatment of the press remains the hardest argument on the reform side. Why limit what Google or Warren Buffett or the AFL-CIO can spend, but not the New York Times or Fox News? The question of how to treat the media is, for the reform community, what the foreign money question is for the deregulationist community. Say there should be an exception, and you run the risk of inconsistency or outright hypocrisy. Say there should not be an exception, and you're considered too extreme. I learned this lesson firsthand when I wrote an article for the Texas Law Review in 1999 called Campaign Finance Laws and the Rupert Murdoch Problem. For shorthand, I sometimes call this article The Reason I Will Never Get a Federal Judge. In the article, I argued that if we ever seriously move to a system of accepting political equality as a rationale for campaign finance regulation, then any newspaper, there were still newspapers back then, any newspaper wanting to endorse a candidate on its editorial page would have to form a PAC and pay for that space the way any other corporation would have. Now, since then, I've changed my position for reasons I'll explain. But the article was not well received. First Amendment scholar Scott Poe wrote a Law Review response titled Boiling Blood. When I presented the paper at a meeting of the American Political Science Association, my mentor and colleague Dan Lowenstein of UCLA half-jokingly described it as Stalinist. Only half jokingly. In 2001, when the Senate was debating the McCain-Feingold law, Senator McConnell placed into the record a National Journal column by Stuart Taylor criticizing my article. McConnell introduced it by stating that Taylor, quote, cautions the media to reconsider its hypocrisy so zealously attacking the First Amendment freedom of every other participant in the political process. Even an eminent First Amendment scholar who privately told me I was right to reject the media exemption for endorsements of candidates as a matter of principle would not say so publicly. The media question is difficult, and most reformers simply ignore it or quickly gloss over it. It's the third rail of the campaign finance debate for good reason. Everyone from ardent reformers to strict deregulationists values a free press. On the other hand, the media are very powerful. How could a campaign finance system rein in the most powerful groups and interests, but leave Rupert Murdoch's media empire, New York Times, and Comcast NBC Universal untouched? This was the point Floyd Abrams pivoted to when I pressed him on how to treat the foreign campaign money question in our 2012 debate. Further, if you believe, as many conservatives do, that there's a liberal media bias, then stopping everyone but the press from unlimited spending will skew the public debate towards left-leaning candidates. Finally, exempting old institutional media, sometimes derisively referred to as the mainstream media, from but not new media from the limits could unfairly benefit certain established groups. It raises the question of how do you define who's the media today? In the end, though, press exceptionalism makes sense. It is a cliche, but still true, to refer to the press as the fourth branch of government, providing an important check on government abuse. Remember, it was two Washington Post reporters who broke the story of Watergate. Newspapers have delved perceptibly and carefully into many scandals involving government officials. Freedom of the press remains sacrosanct in both elite and popular culture for good reason. The press deserves special protection because it serves educational and investigative functions in a more thorough and consistent way than other political actors. Further, with the rise of the internet and social media, claims of liberal media bias or an inability to receive different points of view ring especially hollow. We should read the explicit mention of the press in the First Amendment as embracing these special protections. Now, not all constitutional scholars agree. Professors Eugene Volokh and Michael McConnell have made arguments that the original intent of the constitutional protection for the press was to protect the technology of the printing press and not to protect the profession of journalism. McConnell says that the reason that the Supreme Court was right in Citizens United is that everyone gets the press exemption whenever they spend money on elections. Whether or not Volokh and McConnell have accurately captured the framers' original intent, and on that question, there's reason to have some doubts, saying that we are all the press is to say that no one is the press. The end of press exceptions would have terrible repercussions, potentially eliminating press shield laws and media access to police investigations. When the Supreme Court recently revamped its media policy to deal with controversy over media access to its hearings by the indispensable website SCOTUS blog, it was able to craft a test distinguishing the press from everyone else, even in the era of social media. If the court could do it for its own purposes, it certainly could define the press for constitutional purposes as well. Concern over censorship and preferential press treatment do not doom the equality case for campaign finance reform. It's a careful balancing act, but vouchers and limits is both constitutionally defensible and essential to fair elections as the one person, one vote principle, which says that no eligible voter should have much more voting power than another. The $25,000 individual limit that I propose is a big compromise on political equality. It still gives a wealthy person much more influence than the rest of us who may have nothing more than $100 in vouchers to spend. But this generous limit helps promote robust speech and ensures competitive elections and multiple paths for challenging incumbents. So, finally, how can we move beyond corruption and toward acceptance of political equality to limit money in politics, given the Supreme Court and given political gridlock? A constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United is the most prominent wrong way that has been proposed to fix the problem, even if its supporters were not often engaged only in political theater. Such an amendment would be either too damaging to robust political speech or too full of holes to be effective. Consider the Democrats' proposed constitutional amendment, which at first protected the press when Congress regulated campaign finance, but not when the states regulated campaign finance. Or consider the move to amend proposed amendment, which would deprive all corporations of all constitutional rights, including apparently the New York Times. State of New York wants to shut down the New York Times, pass a law, no problem. When Democrats were pressed on free speech issues as to their amendment, they amended their amendment to allow for only, quote, reasonable restrictions on campaign money, a rule which would put the issue right back before the Supreme Court, which would have to define what a reasonable limit is. Nor should progressives simply give up on reform out of a belief that the role of money in politics is not so bad. It is so bad. Instead, the answer to the problem of money in politics is political change. It turns out it's much easier to change the Constitution by changing the Supreme Court than it is to change the Constitution through a constitutional amendment. For the last two decades, all of the important campaign finance cases the Supreme Court has decided were decided on 5-4 votes, either to narrowly uphold or narrowly strike them down as inconsistent with the First Amendment. We need a Supreme Court that will accept political equality as a compelling interest that justifies reasonable regulations and build the jurisprudence necessary for a new progressive Supreme Court. That court cannot come until after there is additional change, opening up the possibility of a new progressive majority. The 2016 election presents, though, a window for change. When the next president of the United States assumes office on January 20, 2017, Ruth Bader Ginsburg will be nearly 84, Anthony Kennedy will be over 80, and Stephen Breyer will be 78. Justice Scalia's seat may still be open, filled either by President Obama or the next president. Although many justices have served on the court into their 80s and beyond, the average age at which a justice has left the court since 1960 is 79 years old. The next president will have the chance to make, likely have the chance to make multiple appointments to the Supreme Court. What will happen when the next justice comes on the court? My project is about trying to show these new justices that the time has come to rethink the last 40 years and to accept political equality as a reason for limiting money in politics, overturning Buckley, and that part of Buckley that says that the idea that you could promote political equality by limiting campaign money is only foreign to the First Amendment. But this can only happen if it can be shown that a program such as vouchers plus limits will adequately protect for a robust political speech and political competition. So we need to move beyond a partisan world in which Chris Christie bows before Sheldon Adelson, and in which Democrats propose futile amendments to, quote, overturn Citizens United while engaging in essentially the same fundraising practices as Republicans. We should think through these issues before American democracy is too far skewed to the interests of the wealthy, in the hope that some future Supreme Court will be willing to accept reasonable limits on money in politics. Only a focus on America's tradition of political equality can help us to resolve the inevitable tension between our commitment to free economic markets and to voter equality. Otherwise, the plutocrats stand to gain ever greater influence over our democracy. Thank you very much.